All right, 6:11 now on this Monday morning after the day before with the Falcons. Mike Dettelier joins us now, WWL NFL analyst, co-host of Sports Talk. He'll be second-guessing later on this evening, 4 o'clock. Him and Bobby Hebert live on location, Silver Slipper Casino in beautiful Bay St. Louis, Mississippi. They're going to size up the Saints and the Falcons like we're going to do here. Plus, they'll talk about LSU's battle with South Alabama. Then at 6:30, visit Pensacola Saints Coaches Show with Mike Hoss, Bobby Hebert, head coach Dennis Allen, followed at 7 by wide receivers coach Keith Williams. And Monday Night Football, Seahawks at Lions on WWLAMFM.com and live on the free Odyssey app. How you doing, Mike Dettelier?
I'm good. Thank you, Tommy.
Man, it seems like Friday we're talking about Algier and walk-off field goal, and that's kind of what happened, huh?
Pretty much what happened.
And some other stuff in between that wasn't good.
Yeah. No, when you spot somebody 14 points, Tommy, you're not going to win these type games. And it all boils down to that. You had opportunities, and even despite that, you had some opportunities. But again, when you give up, you have two turnovers that turn into 14 points, you're not winning these type of games.
You know, I know stuff happens in the heat of the moment and everything else, but you would think, just generally speaking, that from the time you play little bitty football, they tell you, you know, hey, look, there's no future in fair catching a ball or trying to field a ball at the 3-yard line or 4-yard line.
You learn it pretty quick. Do not field the ball inside the 5-yard line.
Because what's the worst that could happen? It goes out of bounds where? Inside the five-yard line. It just makes no sense. But go ahead.
You understand at that point. And the one thing I will say with Rashid, he's been pretty sure-handed up until yesterday. But, again, talked about this Friday. We've seen some strange things happen in Saints-Falcons game. And mishandle it and turns into 7 points. And then, you know, you get a pass sort of sidearmed. Like trying to throw it away and gets popped up. And Troy Anderson, who had a great game yesterday for Atlanta defensively, he comes up with the pick six interception. So, again, it boils down to that turnovers, both of them touchdowns, and that would seal the deal for the Falcons offensively. They had their moments, Atlanta. The one thing I was surprised, the Saints could not get a good pass rush on Kirk Cousins, mm-hmm. and you can see he's sort of statuesque now. I mean, he ain't moving much from where he's at. They could not influence Kirk on many throws at all, and especially late when you needed it, could not do it.
Did they not try to, like, send any packages or anything like that? Because I didn't see a whole lot of blitzing, and then at the end of the game, and look, it never comes down to one play or anything else, but you know, Koo is going to make that long field goal anyway because the guy's money, right? We all know that. And it just seems like, man, I'd have sent everybody because if you get a sack at the end of the game, then the game's over.
Tommy, I thought the exact same thing. You got to influence him at this stage of his career. And you got to pick and choose because if you decide to put him on every play, he's smart enough. He's going to figure it out. But I thought late. When you needed something,
you
needed to get after him. And also, you play in press man coverage. You one-on-one with receivers downfield. That surprised me a little bit, too. And maybe that has to do with some of the injuries that you sustained. Didn't have Tyrann Mathieu. He goes out during the game. But, man, in that spot, you can't play press man. Because you're going to get beat. It doesn't take much to get beat in that type of situation if you can't influence Kirk Cousins.
I don't know why they didn't, but they didn't. Let's talk about the injury situation with the Saints. Everybody's got injuries. I know it's not an excuse, but also you can't say next man up because if the next man up, as we always say, was as good, he'd be playing, right?
Correct. And then so, you know, you see just how big of an influence Taysom Hill. The offense ran so much better when he was in the lineup. He goes down, hurts his ribs on the other side now. And so who knows situation there with that spot, and then you lose Tyrann Mathieu during the game, and you already missing pieces already with not having Cesar Ruiz at right guard. You didn't have McCoy at center, didn't have Demario Davis at linebacker. So everybody has them, and it's not an excuse. Everybody deals with injuries week to week. That's part of the NFL. It's a season of attrition and how you survive it. But, you came out of that really banged up. And I thought that situation with Taysom, once he got hurt, the offense never ran the same. Again, you see what type of influence he has offensively. I thought for the most part, the offensive line held up pretty well yesterday for what you were playing with new pieces across the board. And to be honest, I thought Atlanta's offensive line held up fairly well with considering they had two new starters along their offensive line. But, man, just a couple plays, Tommy, here and there. And, again, the two plays that were the biggest. You muff a punt that is a score, and then Troy Anderson's pick six. That's what did it.
I heard maybe I misheard Derek Carr after the game, because he was saying that you got to get rid of it quicker. But I went back and watched the interception. He couldn't have been talking about that. He had to be talking about maybe a sack or something.
I think he was talking about the interception. I think he was trying to throw it away, and Judon just stuck that big paw he had out there, and he popped it up. They had difficulties yesterday blocking Judon. Trevor Penning, and they were trying to chip him at times too, but no matter who they put on that side, on that left side, they were getting in, and Trevor had a lot of problems yesterday at right tackle.
But all in all, considering the problems we thought we were going to have on offensive line, I didn't think they played that badly, did you?
No, I didn't think, to be honest, I thought they played better than I expected them to play with a lot of moving parts. And Landon Young, who had primarily played at tackle, they moved him inside to guard. And, again, Shane Lemieux, he's practiced at center, but he's never played a regular season game. At center. I thought, he played a solid game overall. But, again, it comes down to winning and losing. Mm-hmm. You can play good, but, if you don't win the game, it doesn't really matter.
Nope.
You got to keep rolling with it, but it doesn't get any easier, because you see who's coming up next on Monday night. Next week, a week from now, you play the two-time defending champs and a team that's undefeated in the Chiefs.
At home.
Right. In Kansas City.
In Kansas City, that's what I mean, at Arrowhead on a Monday night. So, there's that. 6:20, let's take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. 504-260-1870. You got any questions for Mike Dettillier analyzing the Saints-Falcons game yesterday? Right now it's time for Traffic WWL. 6:25, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Mike Dettillier about the Saints-Falcons game yesterday. Mike, Saints have a hard time stopping the run. You can see it against Philadelphia. You certainly could see it yesterday.
It's a carryover from a year ago. Mm-hmm. This football team has had difficulties stopping the run. And I thought they did a decent job against Bijan, but it was Tyler Allgeier again.
Yep.
And, we brought that up Friday.
Yep.
He has had really good games against this football team. His style of running, he shortcut, built low to the ground. They had difficulties getting him down out into the open field, and he runs hard inside. So I don't get it because that had been a staple for this team for a long time, their ability to stop the run. Last year, difficulties, same thing again this year. The last two games that they have not been able to do it. The one thing against the Chiefs, they've had difficulties running the football with Pacheco down with a broken leg. He's, they're manufacturing things with the little short pass. They're not running the football well at all. In fact, offensively, they look a lot like what they did a year ago. Their defense is bailing them out. And then, again, Mahomes, when you need him, he comes through in the clutch. But, Tommy, I can't explain it why this football team has had so much difficulties in stopping the run. One thing let me throw out, man, you talk about a warrior, and that's Alvin Kamara.
Yeah, we're going to get to that because this man's playing. Man. Anybody that's ever had broken ribs or even a cracked rib knows the pain it takes to breathe. For this man to play an NFL football game like he did yesterday, I don't know how he did it. Plus, he got a hip problem too.
Yeah, and the fact that then once Taysom goes down, then now you really caught in the water.
He's the bell cow. That's exactly right.
Because Jamal, he's going to get you a couple carries, but they're not going to lean on him. They lean on Alvin as a runner and a receiver. And to give the effort, you know, got over 115 yards total offense, you really couldn't ask more. People say today, oh, these guys aren't tough anymore. You better take another look at that. You know, look at what Alvin Kamara put up with yesterday physically to get in that game and play. You can't tell me he ain't a tough guy.
And then you look at what we were talking about before the season with the contract and comparing him to Christian McCaffrey and aging running backs and durability and everything else. Last time I checked, Christian McCaffrey's in Germany, isn't he?
Yeah, he's getting looked at with that Achilles problem, and we'll see that, you know, they're talking about he might come back in November. Mm-hmm. Talk about aging running backs. Anybody watch Sunday Night Football? Watch Derrick Henry. Mm-hmm. God bless him. Man, all those years of watching him and covering and doing coverage for the Titans and everything, and to see what he did there, it's a 30-year-old running back who's taking so many hits. Now, he's given out a lot of them, too. But when he broke out into the open field, that didn't surprise me because he was a track 100, 200-meter champion in high school. Well, you're talking about a 250-pound man outrunning 200-pound guys to the end zone. Amazing to watch that at 30.
And make no mistake about it, Derrick Henry is a man.
He's a man, all right.
He is a man amongst men. Tyler Allgeier, we talked about on Friday, had 227 yards against the Saints in his career, 6.88 yards a carry. Well, yesterday he had 60 yards and he averaged 7.5 yards a carry. So, and somebody texted in and said, why do y'all keep talking about the defense? The Falcons did not score an offensive touchdown. Well, they didn't score an offensive touchdown, but they did score offensive points, especially at the end of the game.
Yeah, well, when you needed it, you couldn't stop.
Right.
And okay, you got a point. They've only given up one defensive touchdown in two games, mm-hmm. and you lost both of them. But, okay, that there are times where you can get off the field. You weren't able to do it yesterday when you needed it, when everything counted. Man, that big pass interference call on Debo really set them up. And like you say, as soon as, you know, they set it up in field goal range, you knew Koo was not going to miss it. He's been money, and especially up against the Saints. He don't miss.
Nope. He does not. We'll take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back. 504-260-187 if you have any questions or comments. We pretty well called it and look, we're wrong about a lot of stuff too, but about the Tyler Allgeier and about the walk-off field goal, because that's exactly what happened. But look, you know, Saints liable to beat the Falcons. It's just the way the series goes when they host them here in the Dome. We'll take a break, pick it up when we come back. Right now, time for WWL First News. 6:45, quarter till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Mike Dettillier, WWL NFL analyst, co-host of Sports Talk. They'll be second-guessing tonight on the beach in Hancock County, Mississippi, Bay St. Louis. It's the Silver Slipper Casino. Starts at 4 o'clock. Head out there, have some fun with them, or listen here on WWL. Mike, you look at where the Saints are now, and you look ahead to the future, and you look at the injury situation and the rest of the season. Give me some reason for optimism.
Well, to be honest with you, I thought they'd be 1-3 at this point, mm-hmm. during the season. I didn't think they'd be 2-2. I think maybe early on those first two games, it was I can't say it was a mirage because it actually happened, But I think a lot of people felt, you're going to get this every game offensively. That wasn't going to be the case. I know we spoke about it so much on Sports Talk. Deuce was the same way, that team's going to adjust to what you do
right.
offensively. And you're not going to put up those points. Your defense, man, has really played pretty well overall. I'd like to get a better pass rush, but they are getting after it and play to run a little bit better. But, man, you really couldn't ask too much more from your defense than what you're getting at this stage. For an NFL defense, those guys get paid, too, on the other side. Offensively, I think that's where this team has got to be able to find maybe another piece of the puzzle here. And especially in the passing game. You saw it yesterday, even with Olave and Rashid had a really good game other than the muff punt as far as receiving, catching the football. I'd love to get one more piece of the puzzle here from the pitch and catch part of the game as a receiver. And, Alvin's carrying the workload for you on offense. You go back to Taysom, and throughout his college career, he had difficulties staying healthy. He's been sort of banged up the last couple of years here and there, but, man, it's starting to pile up now. And so I'd like to see him try to go out and get another piece of the puzzle as a receiver to help your offense out. Offensive line-wise, good luck with that. Mm. Everybody's looking for offensive linemen. And for the most part, I thought the offensive line held up better than I thought it would yesterday, especially with a guy who had never, ever played center before in an NFL game. I thought Shane Lemieux, who I knew could play because he was a starting guard with the Giants, but he couldn't stay healthy. Mm. The Giants hated to cut him loose. But, you know, they had sort of gotten tired of the constant injuries with him. I thought he played pretty well yesterday at that center spot. So, nobody's running away with this, Tommy. Nobody in the NFC is running away with this. The Vikings look good now, but, you know, other than them, everybody's got their problems. Mm-hmm. Every other team in the NFC has got their issues.
Tell me about running back with the Saints, because I don't know how beat up Alvin Kamara is after yesterday. I don't know what's behind him. Jamal Williams is not showing me a lot of anything.
Well, there I agree. We had some guy call Thursday.
Yeah.
He won a debate that Jamal Williams is the best running back the Saints have on the team.
I hope he wasn't
because
driving.
He's averaging more per carry than Taysom and Alvin, which, man, again, I know they got sales on TVs, but that's beside the point. You got what you got at running back. And Alvin is banged up, but he's going to answer the bell. Again, those type running backs, it's difficult to go out and get that bell cow guy that can carry a big load for you offensively. Other teams are looking for that, too. There's just so many, you know, just a few guys that can do it at that level, Tommy. They just not on the side of the street with their hands up in the air. So when you have injuries like they do with Taysom and they have with Alvin, who's been able to fight through it, that's what you got the rest of the season.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. We'll look ahead to the Chiefs game, which is on Monday night there in Kansas City, which, you know, you can – probably have picked a better place to play or maybe a better team to play at this point. But again, like Mike's saying, it's the NFL, and that's what's so frustrating about it is you can find some positives out of the game yesterday, but it was just so close and just like every Falcons game. 6:50, 10 till 7, traffic now, WWL. Back with Mike Dettelier, Tommy Tucker, WWL 655. Mike, before we get to the Chiefs, you know, I'm looking at the stats here with receptions. Other than Olave and Shahid, really, the tight ends were non-existent. Tipton had a target. I think Johnson had three targets, two receptions. Kamara was the third leading targeted receiver. You got Olave at 10, Shahid at 11, and Kamara at 9. Not a lot of real distribution there when it comes to Saints receivers. Are we looking at Olave and Shaheed, and that's about it?
It's about it. You hope that Tipton can come around to help you, but the tight ends have not been a big part of this attack, and that's why I say, man, I'd maybe make a phone call or two to see if I can't get me another receiver to help out in the pitch catch part of the game, because this isn't going to change, okay? It isn't going to change unless you change personnel and bring in somebody else.
Saints have had a hard time in the past. We talk about stopping the run, containing quarterbacks, and Patrick Mahomes has been known to take off, you know.
Yeah, one thing with Patrick, he's not considered a runner. Mm-hmm. He more scrambles around to try to buy time for his receivers, but he will run it if you give him an opportunity. Tommy, it's so reminiscent. It's almost carbon copy of a year ago. The Chiefs are winning because of their defense, and now they've got all these injuries on offense. They've lost their two starting receivers in Rashee Rice for the season, Hollywood Brown for the season. Isaiah Pacheco with a leg issue, a broken leg, he's out, I think, another 6 to 7 weeks. And you can see with Travis Kelce, he's in the winter years of his NFL career. And yet they still find a way to win. You look at game one. The Ravens had him. Then two errant passes late, and the point of a shoe gets out of bounds, and they end up with a W. Joe Burrow and the Bengals had him. And, you know, then you had a defensive back. He tries to run through a wide receiver, and that was an interference play. It gives them an opportunity, walk-off field goal, and win the game. You look at Atlanta. They had opportunities to win that game on Sunday night. Could not put them away. Yesterday, I thought the Chargers were going to put the L. I thought they were going to give them the first L. Sure enough, their defense has played terrific, and they've done just enough on offense to win. People, oh, the referees cheat for them. Are they lucky? No, they find a way to win. You got to give it to Andy Reid. He's found a different way to win. He's an offensive-oriented coach, but he's found a way to win with a kicking game and great defense. Because his skill sets on offense have really been diminished because of injuries. You still have Mahomes late in the game, that he comes up with a play or two that ends up pulling it out. So I expect a close game against Kansas City. I really do. They are not going to blow anybody out at this stage. They don't have the offensive firepower to do so. Figure out a way to win. Figuring out a way to win. That's what Reed has done. They're such a well-coached football team in Kansas City. I give them credit. They're maximizing everything they have on offense. It's not great, but boy, what they got on defense is really good. And in today's world, it's an anomaly.
Yeah,
see that type defense.
Andy Reid's going to have to get that thinking cap on again after losing Rashee Rice yesterday after running into Mahomes.
Yeah.
So with the ACL.
And so now you got injuries stacking up. And yet they 4-0.
Got to find a way to win. That's what it's all about, huh, Mike?
That's it. That's all it's all about.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it, as always. We'll listen.
Thank you, Tommy.
We'll listen this afternoon. Mike Dettelier, Bobby Hebert, second guest, live on location, Silver Slipper, Bay St. Louis. He'll talk about the Saints and LSU, then the visit Pensacola Saints coaches show at 6:30. Mike Haas, Bobby Hebert, head coach Dennis Allen, then at 7, wide receivers coach Keith Williams. Then it's Monday Night Football, Seahawks at Lions, all here on WWLAMFM.com, free Odyssey app. Talk to Jeff Palermo about LSU when we come back. 7:14 now on this Monday morning. Not so good for the Saints. LSU, however, came through. Jeff Palermo joins us now, WWL.com columnist, Louisiana Network news director. How you doing, Jeff?
Oh, I'm doing well, Tommy. How about yourself?
I'm all right. Caden Durham's doing pretty well. He had him a night on Saturday night, huh?
He couldn't get off to a better start, right? Swing pass out to him. Well, it was a short swing pass out to him, and then the long run, and then that was on the first offensive play of the game. That was, what, a 76-yard touchdown pass, and then it had an 80-yard-plus run. on the next drive that set up a one-yard touchdown run by Garrett Nussmeier. Unfortunately, he left the game early, and it's been reported that he suffered two dislocated toes. I've heard of a lot of football injuries. I've never heard of a player suffering two, not just one, but two dislocated toes. Now, of course, LSU doesn't have a game this Saturday. Mm-hmm. Coach Brian Kelly said after the game, it's not a serious injury, but I don't know. We'll see. Hopefully he's ready to go October 12th when the Tigers take on Ole Miss.
To be clear, you're talking about Garrett Nussmeier having
No. Caden Durham had the dislocated toes. That's why he left early in that game.
All right, I misunderstood what you were saying, because that's a big difference, because I'm thinking Garrett Nussmeier maybe be a difference as opposed to let's hope that gets better. I guess you would think dislocated as opposed to broken, you just kind of put them back where they're supposed to be. I'm no doctor, obviously, and then they're sore, so I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah. And, you know, the thing is, though, for a running back like him that really relies on his speed, because this is going to be Caden Durham plans on being a two-sport athlete at LSU. Mm-hmm. He also plans to run track, so speed is a big part of his game, and you just don't want to hear about any kind of you don't want to hear about any injury with a football player, but a guy that relies so much on his speed, you don't want to hear about any kind of a foot injury. But it is good that at least LSU does not have a game to worry about this Saturday.
I did not see the game. Full disclosure, I got to admit, I was busy and didn't have a chance to see it. Tell me what else you took away from the game on Saturday night.
Well, I guess to talk about Garrett Nussmeier, really good game for him again. He threw for over 400 yards. He did throw for two interceptions, his first multi-interception game this season. The second one, he ended up receiving a tongue-lashing from Brian Kelly when he got to the sidelines. It was not a good throw from him. He's been very good this season in taking care of the football, making sure he doesn't throw it in a dangerous spot that can lead to a turnover, but he did there. Who knows? I mean, you're up big. Maybe you get a little bit careless with the football, and I think that's kind of what happened with Garrett Nussmeier. I thought it was a good performance from the offensive line. The defensive line and the linebackers, I thought, played really well in this game. We talked a lot about this South Alabama team coming into Tiger Stadium as a very good offensive team, a team that is – put up a lot of points, but LSU only gives up just the one touchdown. They had a great goal line stand where Whit Weeks knocked the helmet off the ball carrier as he was trying to get into the end zone. I thought that was a great play. You didn't notice the absence of Harold Perkins, and I think a lot of that was because of the great linebacker play that they got from Whit Weeks and Greg Penn. Safety remains a focal point defensively for this team. I mean, Coach Brian Kelly was pretty blunt with his assessment afterwards, talking about, hey, we're rotating a lot of guys in there, trying to figure out what's the best combination at free and strong safety. Well, it's time to stop the rotations. They got to figure out who are the two or three guys that they're going to be really counting on at the safety position, because from here on out, it's now all SEC games and a big one coming up on October 12th. So, I think with this week and practice, they're going to try to really narrow it down to, okay, we got all this game film on these guys. Who are our two or three best guys? And so we'll see who they decide to roll with against the Rebels on October 12th.
What about the LSU defensive backs?
Yeah, I mean, that's a big problem at the safety position. I thought the cornerbacks, they didn't necessarily get tested too much in this game. I think there was so much concern about the defensive line. I think it has been a pleasant surprise at how well they are playing. Ahmad Bro, a true freshman, has really played well. He graded out well, according to Pro Football Focus. They're getting outstanding pressure from their defensive ends, Braden Swinson and Savion Jones. Those two guys are playing really well. There was a lot of concern about that defensive line, and those concerns grew even louder when Jacobian Guillory went down with the torn Achilles tendon in the Nichols game. But I tell you what, I think that I've been impressed. I've been impressed at how well they've come along. JVR Suggs, he's on the smaller end, and he only plays a handful of plays, but when he's out there, he's making plays. And so it's been nice to see Now we'll see how well they really do hold up now that it's just all SEC games from here on out.
Yeah, it gets serious real quick with Ole Miss, who's coming off the loss. And I don't know if you saw the Georgia-Alabama game or not. I turned it off and went to bed, and I thought, sure, that there was no way Georgia came back. But they did, didn't they?
Unbelievable game. Unbelievable game, Tommy. And yeah, that game looked like it was over with. And you're sitting there going, as you're watching that game, I was watching both LSU South Alabama and Alabama Georgia. And Alabama is just putting it on Georgia. I mean, they're up 28-0 in that game. And then Georgia just kept battling back, and they scored. When they scored that touchdown, Tommy, and you saw what Bryant-Denny Stadium looked like, and it was a great job by the ABC television crew, because all the different images of the LSU fans with their jaws down to the floor and they're just a look of shock. I mean, that could have been a really crushing loss for Alabama to blow a lead like that at home. There would be a lot of talk about, hey, first-year coach, this would never happen with Nick Saban, blah, blah, blah. But then Alabama scores on the next play. And for those that really think that the Alabama dynasty is over with, and I don't know, it's probably never going to be like it was with Nick Saban, as strong as they were. But, you know, it's a true freshman wide receiver who catches the winning touchdown pass, and it's a true freshman cornerback that gets the interception that seals the victory. So there's still plenty of talent on this Alabama team. They are still a well-coached group. They have a coach that has won at a high level everywhere he has gone. So Alabama is not going away, but it was a fun game. It's what makes college football so terrific, to see two great teams like that play. And even though when it seemed like it was going to be a runaway for Alabama, Georgia just really battled back and gave us one of the best games of the year, it turns out.
A lot of fuel in that Alabama tank. I'm going to tell you what, 7:21 and a half. We'll pick it up here. We come back. Traffic now, WWL. 7:27, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Jeff Palermo, WWL.com columnist, Louisiana Network News Director. Big win against South Alabama. But from here on in, nothing but SEC competition. Ole Miss on October 12th, I think it is, right?
That's right, Tommy.
Tell me what we know about this Ole Miss team.
Well, that was a tough loss for the Rebels on Saturday to the Wildcats. I mean, they went into that game, I believe, a 17-point favorite. And Ole Miss has been cruising through their season. I mean, they've played the likes of Furman, Georgia Southern. you know, they went to Wake Forest. They won there, but Wake Forest is not a very good team. And this was really the first time they've been challenged, and they failed miserably. This was you're expecting a high-powered Lane Kiffin offense, and they really struggled offensively in this game. So now Ole Miss has got to pick up the pieces, and they got to play against South Carolina now after losing to Kentucky, and then they head to LSU. So it looked like, you know, heading into this season, that Ole Miss was in a really good spot considering their schedule and how good their team is supposed to be. This looked like a team that was going to make the 12-team college football playoff, but that's now in serious doubt. And, you know, there's a couple ways to look at this. Is one, you know, Ole Miss, as I just mentioned, has not been tested at all this season until this game against Kentucky. And, you know, they only score 17 points. Jackson Dart had an okay game, 260 yards passing. Trey Harris continues to be a monster for them at wide receiver. But this is this is the reason why LSU plays a tough opponent at the beginning of the season, because you learn so much more about your team when you play those kind of games early on in the season. When Ole Miss was beating Furman by 70 points, they learn absolutely nothing about their team. I mean, LSU is so far ahead of Ole Miss at this point of understanding what their deficiencies are and how to improve them. It really helps them in, you know, as you move along in the season And I thought that was an example of what we saw here this past Saturday.
And Ole Miss is not off until the LSU game. Ole Miss plays South Carolina this week, correct?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, so they got and we saw South Carolina could be a tough team. And kudos to Kentucky. They looked really bad in their loss to South Carolina earlier this year. And Kentucky has improved this so much here in recent weeks. Nearly beat Georgia, and then they do pull off the upset against Ole Miss.
You think you know, but you don't know till you line up, do you?
Right, exactly.
Thank you, Jeff. Pleasure as always, Jeff Palermo, WWL.com, Louisiana Network News Director. When we come back, we're going to take a look at the week ahead on Wall Street. We call it Monday Morning Markets with Mark Rosa, President and CEO of Jefferson Financial Federal Credit Union. It is next here on WWL. 7:45, quarter till 8, Monday morning, Tommy Tucker, WWL. That means it's time to join Mark Rosa, President and CEO of Jefferson Financial Federal Credit Union, for Monday Morning Markets with Mark, where we take a look at the week ahead on Wall Street. How you doing, Mark?
Tommy, good morning. How are you?
I'm okay. Hard to believe that the third quarter ends today.
That's right. It is hard to believe. And tomorrow starts the fourth quarter of the year. We're still getting economic news from even back on the second quarter, GDP. I'll go over it in a second. But, Wall Street has been breaking records. It's like the 40th record that was broken on the S&P. We broke records again last week. They're encouraged about the near-term future of the economy. I think there's enough headwinds, but, I got to yield to whatever the market is thinking. And they didn't have a lot of economic news that came out last week, but the few things that did come out were pretty big items. We had personal income that continues to grow. I mean, that's good to fight inflation, and we needed that over the past couple of years. And it's growing incrementally each time we report on it. So it came out for August numbers, supposed to be up 0.4%, 0.4, which would be about a 5% annual rate. And it didn't. It missed the mark. It came in only up 0.2%, but still it was up. And then when it seems like every time personal income is up, personal spending is up. It was up by the like amount, both of them missing what Wall Street expected. But again, they were both in positive territory. And we had the Fed's preferred inflation gauge, of course. All the analysts sit at the very front 1 inch of their chair waiting for that news to come out. And when it came out favorably, that's what produced the record last week, the record in the Dow. So the personal consumption expenditure, when you hear somebody say PCE, that's what they're referring to for August. And it was up 0.2% the previous month, and it came in for August up 0.1%. So, Tommy, the significance there is we take those monthly numbers, we multiply them by 12 to get an annual rate for comparison purposes and looking at rates as we're moving through the year. So up 0.1%, that's inflation was up 1.2% in essence for the year. If you looked at August numbers and extrapolated it out, they also produce it. And somebody might say, well, 1 month does not a trend make. So you have to have maybe a companion statistic that comes out to show us, what's happening. So the year over year, they produce that as well. And in July, it was up 2.5% for a year inflation. This past month in August, it was supposed to be up 2.3, and it came in lower than that 2.2. So if they were looking at getting it down to 2% on the monthly basis, this is what a lot of analysts were complaining about earlier in the year. On a monthly basis, if you keep producing 0.1% increases, inflation is happening at barely over a 1% annual rate. The trouble with that I would have, and just speak for myself, over the year over year, you're taking numbers that are 12 months old and you're factoring those in to produce that average. And even when we're doing that, it's coming in at 2.2%. So some analysts are saying, oh, you're well within 1% category because you're factoring in larger numbers that were averaging over the past. And so we're well into striking distance. And that's where it goes back to when people were saying, well, they missed the mark. They should have lowered rates because they might push the economy into deflation or negative growth, and that's what they're trying to avoid. So they should have maybe reduced interest rates in July. They made up for it in their August meeting, actually September meeting, reducing rates by 50 basis points. And now the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, their Fed Watch tool, looks at the Fed's meeting in 38 days, and it's flipped over. The majority of the analysts responding for the next meeting were saying that, no, they're going to only reduce rates by 25 basis points at this next go round. But actually, it's 53% now feel that they're going to push rates down by another 50 basis points at the next meeting. So that would be significant, but it's also a signaling mechanism. If you're playing catch up and you're doubling up on what would be a normal Fed rate change, increase or decrease, they like quarter point changes, and you're doubling up on these. Are you trying to play catch up, or have you missed the mark back when? Should you have done more earlier to fend off what was going on in the economy before we slip into a recession? But many, again, like I was mentioning, many on Wall Street think they're going to engineer a soft landing. Think the economy is in decent health and it's going to weather all these changes that are going on. GDP, the final revision came out for the second quarter. Economy is growing at 3%. So that's a healthy level for, not everybody knows this, ours, the U.S. economy, is the largest in the world by a significant margin. So when you're trying to turn our economy around and modify its trajectory there, it's very difficult, because at the most recent reading, ours is a $29 trillion economy. That's what GDP is. All the value of the goods and services that are produced in the U.S. For a period of time. And they measure that quarterly. They produce those numbers quarterly. They revise them after they produce them. So this was the second and last revision for second quarter. You started off the segment right. We're finishing the third quarter now, and they start the party all over again. So by the end of October, we'll get third quarter numbers of GDP. But again, Tom, it's been healthy. And the market has responded the same, and again, breaking records here. So the next big part of economic news to come out would be the non-farm payrolls coming out Friday for September. And it's expected to be about 144,000 new jobs would be created in September. Now, this is the payroll number has probably been the most concerning, because it used to be around 300,000 a month. Then it got into the twos. Now it's in the mid ones. So that's what the Fed has said before in previous meetings. We're worried about the employment numbers. If a lot of layoffs and so on start to accumulate, and we've reported on those in past segments, that's, I think, the single biggest worry is what's happening with the labor market.
So I guess as a takeaway, what could derail this?
Well, you could have I meant to say tomorrow starts fourth quarter, but it also puts us into earnings season. Mm-hmm. So two things that Wall Street likes, two things that determine stock prices, is interest rates, and they go in the right direction, down, and corporate earnings. So the right direction there would be up to maintain the stock prices where they are at these levels. It's Dow at over 42,000. So what could derail it? A very weak labor market and the accumulated layoffs that we've been talking about in previous segments. If that starts to those numbers start to get higher, the unemployment rate starts to get higher, I think that would be a big worry for the Fed. Because back to GDP, Tom, the consumer makes up 70% of the GDP numbers. So if we're pulling back collectively as a group and saying, you know, I think I just get feelings that the economy is slowing. There's some talk at work about, you know, we're not producing as much as we used to, and whatever industry you're in, all those conversations lead up to possibly a consumer saying, you know what, I was going to take another trip, or I was going to do this or buy a boat or whatever. Maybe I'll wait. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'll wait until some of this clears up and we get a better footing on what the economy is. That has produced recessions in the past. The consumer saying, I'm just pulling back on spending. And that's all it takes to push GDP down. And if it pushes it into negative numbers, that was the old definition of a recession. If the GDP numbers were being reported as a negative number, that means the economy was actually shrinking. Instead of adding to GDP, we're reducing from GDP. And that used to signal the old definition of recession. Oh, you're in a recession. GDP fell negative. When it used to fall negative for two consecutive quarters, that was the end of it. That was definitely a recession. But with these numbers, it seemed, you know, and we're looking at second quarter. So that's when the summer was just kind of in its peak. So I think that has contributed to second quarter GDP as we move into the fall and people's travel are finished and those types of things. That'll be very telling going forward.
Very valuable information. Thank you, Mark.
Thank
pleasure
you,
as always. And we'll talk to you
my
Friday
pleasure.
When you help us manage our money with Mark Rosa, President and CEO of Jefferson Financial Federal Credit Union. 754, 6 till 8. Traffic now, WWL. 8:15, the Causeway southbound is closed. Keep that in mind. If you're trying to get from the North Shore to the South Shore, you cannot take the Causeway. That's because of an accident. We'll let you know if anything changes on that. But between now and then, keep in mind that the Causeway heading to the South Shore is closed. Tim Temple joins us on Louisiana Insurance Commissioner. Good morning, Tim. How are you?
Hey, good morning, Tommy.
This the damage from Helene, you know, and I don't know if you've been to Asheville or not, and Chimney Rock and all of that. I have, and it's amazing to see in a bad way the devastation that they're looking at. And then when you look all along the path of Helene as it made its way north, would that or could that have anything to do on reinsurance and our insurance rates here?
Yeah, Tommy, I mean, first, I think we got to keep in mind, as always, that, you know, there's to date, 91 people have lost their lives. And mm-hmm. the last report I saw this morning, still 1,000 people unaccounted for. You know, people have not been able to get in touch with people, with others and loved ones. So let's keep all of those people and families in our prayers. Look, this was, the word unprecedented is going to get used a lot. We watched this storm closely from its formation all the way as it came on shore and went up through the Carolinas and Georgia. And I don't think anyone predicted the amount of rain that was going to come from this. So it is unprecedented, but I'll tell you that in the latest numbers I saw, they were – and this is early, so everybody needs to keep this in mind. It's early. They were forecasting somewhere between $3 and $5 billion in insured losses as a result of the actual hurricane force winds. These are early numbers. This morning I was reading over $10 billion in economic loss. I think that number is going to be light, mm-hmm. And somewhere between $20 to $25 billion total. But again, these are, you know, we're still early in it. I mean, there are still places that are continuing to flood. So we're just going to have to wait and watch and see. This is going to impact the National Flood Insurance Program. I was looking at some numbers this morning in anticipation of the call, trying to see kind of what policy force they have in count. And, you know, in Louisiana, we have about 440,000 flood policies. Mm-hmm. It's about 1% of our population, if you will. And I don't have the count for, you know, buildings and, that kind of percentage. But Georgia has about 72,000 flood policies. North Carolina, about 129,000 policies. So, you know, there were other states that have some serious flooding, South Carolina and Virginia. So I think this is going to impact the NFIP program. But as far as the reinsurance for you and I, on the, on our property, on our wind coverage, I think. The numbers haven't come in yet to know, but I don't see it being, you know, as bad as it could have been.
So the primary concern is going to be flood.
It's looking like it. Now, look, you know, again, Florida did take a pretty good punch from the hurricane and does have a lot of damage as a result of the hurricane. But I think, as we were saying on your program or another program, where it came in that big bend area, I mean, that is the least populated portion of that state. So there weren't as many policies, relatively speaking.
This really does speak to the importance, and I know they run the public service announcements about everybody needs flood insurance. But, you know, I was saying earlier, I think Asheville's 2,000 feet above sea level, 300 feet in from the coast. But you never know, do you?
You don't. And again, this morning when I was looking at the database, the NFIP maintains data for every state, every parish. I think you can even drill down to zip code if you want to. But, you know, there are policies all throughout our state or our country. Every state that, you know, has some policy count. And so it doesn't mean that, I mean, look, Colorado has flood policies in it. So it just because you're halfway up a mountain doesn't mean that you can't flood. And I think that's been evidenced now by the devastation we're seeing in in the mountain region on the East Coast.
Yeah, let me pick it up. We come back. Did you see 60 Minutes last night or not?
I did.
Okay, we'll talk about that as well. Tim Temple, our guest, Louisiana Insurance Commissioner. You got any questions, comments, 504-260-1870. Text them in. I'll pass them along. Right now, time for traffic, WWL. 824, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Tim Temple, Louisiana Insurance Commissioner. If you've just tuned in and heard about the causeway, Carlton Dufour Show called us and said the southbound causeway is now opened. So you can use that as you make your way into work. Tim Temple also talked about the damage from Hurricane Helene, and as you move further inland, would appear initially, and correct me if I'm saying this wrong, Tim, would initially appear to be more of a flood concern than a wind concern, accurate or not, as insurance goes?
We're early, but it appears that most of the damage is going to be from flood-related versus wind-related. It doesn't mean that you didn't have the damage there, but at least the majority, initial appearance seems to be more flood.
So I was talking about the 60 Minutes piece last night. A lot of people saw it. A lot of people are texting in about it. If you can, Commissioner, you can probably encapsulate it better than I can since you are in the industry. Explain what it showed.
Yeah, look, I watched that last night, and the company that they focused on, they highlighted where it appears that they, after the results of Hurricane Ian in Florida, that you had a particular company that were coming in, and I think the phrase used was lowballing claim estimates. Mm-hmm. And I think that highlights why you need to have, a very active relationship with the companies to ensure that they are doing what their mission is, which is to pay claims and pay claims fairly. In Louisiana, we have recently passed some laws to help people understand, the consumers understand what their rights are when a company is in bad faith. And, I can tell you that, as Commissioner of Insurance, whenever we have the next event, if I'm in this chair, I'm going to work to make sure that the companies are doing right by the consumers and paying claims quickly and accurately.
People are texting in about the flood insurance program and a national some type, and I'll ask Bill Cassidy about this, the senator, when we talk to him next half hour, but about the possibility of some type of national disaster insurance where I guess everybody would pay into it and it would cover fire or flood or hurricane or whatever. Is there a place for that with the federal government? And if so, what would that do to the private insurance market? And for people that are advocating that, I would say, well, let me ask you how flood insurance is working out for you now. And is that really what you want? Your thoughts on all of that, Tim, since you are an insurance guy. I mean, that's what you do for life's work, right?
Yeah, Tommy, look, I would echo what you just said. I mean, are those same people, are they the ones advocating and promoting the National Flood Insurance Program? Show me a federal program that works well like that, and then we can have a discussion about it. But look, I don't think that is the route to go. I mean, we are certainly looking at for whatever reason, hurricanes are impacting, seem to come more frequently, seem to be more intense at times. But we're also got to look at the concentration. I mean, that's one thing that I haven't seen really introduced in the conversation is when these storms are coming on shore, look at the number of properties there versus 10, 20, 30 years ago. I mean, we are building and putting more people, condensing them in the same footprint, a smaller footprint, if you will. And so when a storm does come on shore, there's more property to be damaged. So I think we have to have that discussion as well as far as, when you allow buildings to be built or homes to be built. We've got to have that conversation. Do we want to concentrate large numbers of properties in these small areas? So, but if you have the federal government come in and compete with the private industry, look at flood. How many companies are out there writing flood coverage right now in the U.S.? Not many, because you cannot compete with the federal government. They can make it cheap if they want to. They can subsidize it with our dollars, or if they don't have our dollars, they'll just print more money. So I don't think that a federal national disaster recovery program is the way to go. I don't know what the exact answer is, but we need to start having those conversations. But private has worked, and we need to continue to try and promote that.
Ultimately, it comes down to actuarial tables, and the basic insurance model has to be that more people buy insurance that and don't use it than do, correct?
That's correct.
So with that being the underlying rule, how do you fix insurance companies and mitigate risk other than, I guess, not insuring properties for wind and hail or whatever when they're on the coast? I'm trying to figure out what you just told me, Tim, and put all that together.
I think, Tommy, part of what we're trying to do is we also need to continue to mitigate and create properties that are more resilient as these storms come in. You know, we do things like we're doing coastal restoration. We do, you know, building of levees, elevating of properties. Now we're starting for the first time in Louisiana to build homes more resilient to wind with fortified roofs, fortified doors, fortified windows. We need to continue to promote that because we can't just tell people, you know, as you've heard and it's been said, we have a working coast. We need to have an affordable housing market in South Louisiana to keep, you know, our economy running.
We need to
also build more mitigation.
All right, thank you, Tim. Appreciate it. Tim Temple, Louisiana Insurance Commissioner. We'll talk to Senator Bill Cassidy. Let me just ask you, the audience, 504-2601. All right, 8:45, quarter till 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by U.S. Senator Bill Cassidy. How you doing, Senator?
I'm doing really well, Tommy, except for the Saints yesterday. I'm doing great.
Yeah, I need a prescription for that, doctor, if you can write me something to make that memory go away. Let's talk about what happened with Helene and flood insurance and you know, the basic insurance model, right? And I was talking to Tim Temple about this just now, is more people have to pay into it than use it, or else the company's not going to be in business. That's not the way insurance works. The people that pay for the ones that use it are the ones that don't use it. That's accurate, is it not?
It absolutely is accurate. And what's happening with the National Flood Insurance Program is that they are trying to pay back the debt going all the way back to Katrina, when federally built levees failed.
Yep.
They're trying to pay back that debt now, in addition to spread the risk out among everybody. Now, you can spread the risk out among everybody, but you're not going to be able to pay back that debt and the interest on the debt, by the way, from levees that the federal government built and that failed. So if I'm a little frustrated by this, I am.
No, I can understand.
I'll point out.
No, because you're right. Katrina missed the city. It's the failure of the levees that they built that the studies in Vicksburg showed them would fail the flood walls that they did anyway.
And so now in that premium that somebody's paying for the flood insurance program, is paying back the interest and the principal on all the accumulated debt. Now, if you just took that money, say, just take the interest. One of the reforms I propose is just suspend the interest and use it to mitigate the risk of flooding. Now, it's been shown, recent report, that if you, whatever you invest in mitigating the risk of flooding, you actually get back much more in terms of decreasing the expenditures from the program. So this is kind of looking forward as trying to make amends for that which has passed. And by the way, Helene shows is not just a Louisiana problem, not just a Florida problem. It is a Carolinas problem. It is a Tennessee problem. It is going to be an Ohio problem. And they just stopped writing flood insurance in California, one carrier did, because of a California problem. So we've got to fix the program.
And don't forget North Carolina. I guess you've been, I presume, Senator, you've been in Asheville and that area and Chimney Rock and all that?
I have been. I'm thinking the Biltmore flooded?
Yeah, I have too, and it's a beautiful area. That's 2,000 feet above sea level, 300 feet inland, and I guess I'm just thinking that when it comes to, I don't know, you don't want the government to force people to buy insurance. Maybe you do, maybe you don't. People text me about some kind of national disaster insurance program. I don't know if you do it through a tax or whatever you do, but it just, and I forget what happened with Obamacare and the Commerce Amendment. I forgot exactly how that turned out, the Commerce Clause. But the point I'm making is the only way you could have a national insurance plan is if everybody paid into it, right? And then it covered, I'm talking about the model here, and then it would cover fire, forest fires, or not anything that happened within your home, but something that happened exterior. You understand where I'm going with this?
I know exactly where you're going. My problem is I can't get the people from Utah to support it.
Yeah.
Or the people from Wyoming. And now, by the way, they have their own problems. They have drought. They have an occasional flood, but politically it's been difficult to convince people. So my sights are, what do we do to reform the National Flood Insurance Program? Well, we just voted for a spending bill which reauthorizes it through December the 20th. So we got to still going. We got to get it going for the whole year. Then we need to reform it so that it's going to be more affordable, more sustainable, more accountable. And I've got a commitment that we'll have a hearing on our bill and a markup on the bill next Congress. So I'm pleased about that.
Was this about $206 million from FEMA's Flood Mitigation Assistance Program? What's that for?
Yeah, speaking of which, in the bipartisan infrastructure bill, again, I call it a Cassidy Amendment. You weren't supposed to have earmarks, but we said that there's going to be $3 billion to mitigate risk of flooding, prioritizing areas that flooded in the previous 10 years. Well, that was like Louisiana and Texas and Superstorm Sandy. So we got $206 million this time. Texas got a little bit more this year. We usually get more than Texas. But most of it's going to the New Orleans area, like almost $52 million going to Gretna for a distributed green network. The city of New Orleans is getting $11 million for elevation projects. Jefferson Parish is getting $9 million. St. Tammany Parish is getting $5 million. All to mitigate risk of flooding. Mandeville specifically, Slidell specifically, St. Charles Parish. This money is coming to our state, to our region, to lower the risk of flooding. And it's all because of the infrastructure bill, and I'm proud to have been a part of it.
What's going on with the FEMA and methodology and risk rating 2.0, where does all of that stand? Is anything? Oh, let me clean this up. I'm getting some text here. I said that Asheville was 300 feet inland. Obviously, it's not 300 feet inland. It's 300 miles inland. I misspoke. But well, what's going on with the 2.0? And have any books been opened? Is anybody looking at methodology here? Are we any closer to seeing what the hell's happening?
Well, so for those who are listening, the National Flood Insurance Program, which is run by FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, put out a new way to rate the risk of an individual's risk of flooding called Risk Rating 2.0. Some people got lower premiums. A lot of people who had never flooded, who are behind flood control structures, are seeing double-digit premiums every year compounding. And when you look at kind of their rationale, it's really not clear. It's really not clear how they're coming to these decisions. So they've met with my staff. They got us on the spreadsheet. You'd have to be there with them explaining it to you to understand it, but they've not put it out there for homeowners and for developers. The bill that we'll have a hearing on and a vote on committee next Congress, which will be like in January, February, March, will actually put in reforms that will lower the cost for premiums. And put in reforms that will do it while maintaining the actuarial soundness of the program. So we got work to do, but I've got a commitment from my committee chair, my committee ranking member, that they will have this hearing and they'll vote on my bill next Congress. We're making progress.
Real quick before I let you go, because I know you're in Washington right now, Louisiana?
Oh, no, I'm in Louisiana, going down to Waggaman.
Are you really? It's lovely this time of year.
It is gorgeous today, although I think it's getting a little hot, but still it's not so humid. It's wonderful.
Waggaman's a great place to be this time of year. What are you doing at Waggaman?
Just meeting with a work site, going over there to Cornerstone Energy Park and meeting with some CF Industries and, you know, just a lot of good-paying jobs, supporting families, supporting better futures. I'm all about that, trying to bring more business to our state.
I was asking an economist last week about debt and deficit and Social Security reform, and I don't see where anybody ever has the political will to stand up and risk not being reelected to do what it takes. I'm not talking about you, but to do whatever it takes to really reform Social Security or stabilize Social Security despite what we're hearing is going to happen for people that are already receiving it. Your thoughts on that?
So we are working on a plan. And our plan is different than other plans in which we set up an investment fund. Now, I like this because Trump just recently announced he would like to set up an investment fund for the federal government. And John Paulson, who's somebody famous in the finance world, is supporting his idea. I've been working on this for 4 years. And so if Trump's elected, when Trump's elected, we can take this to him, say, listen, if you want to bail out social, we've got everything worked out to put in an investment plan. We put $1.5 trillion in it over 5 years, invest it in the economy, allow the investment to grow just like you do your 401k, and you put every return back into it. And it's about 70 years from now, and that's how long you think about for social, it pays off almost all of the debt associated with Social Security. Nobody gets a cut in benefit. In fact, under our plans, we do things like repeal windfall elimination program, and so we make the benefit program a little bit better. And I like it because Trump is saying, well, this is the way we go. Boom, we got the legislation for it to work.
But you'd have to have the congressional support for that, right?
Oh, absolutely. But we had 14 senators, 7 Republicans, 7 Democrats who were supporting the plan last Congress. And then we reviewed it with the Biden White House, and they just said, no, we don't want to do it. In fact, I may have told you this, but he gives the State of the Union. He attacks Republicans on social. As we walk out, one of my Democratic colleagues says, well, he's running for re-election attacking you guys. There's no way we can get this through. And so we've just put it, you know, okay, we're not going to work on it yet. We're not going to make it public yet. But this is all reported in the newspapers. I'm not telling you anything that isn't public. Mm-hmm. But the fact that Trump is saying, wait a second, he wants an investment fund. We've been working on it, and he can bail out social.
All right. Anything else, Senator, before we let you go?
No, man. Good interview, Tommy. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for talking to us. We'll talk to you again soon. Dr. Mr. Senator Bill Cassidy, 855, Traffic Now, WWL. Matriculating through Monday morning, 909. Rafael Goyeneche joins us now, president of the Metropolitan Crime Commission. How you doing, Rafael?
I'm fine, Tommy. How are you?
Well, you know, I was doing okay up until, I guess, about a minute left in the Atlanta game yesterday, and then it seems like...
2 seconds left. Yeah. 2 seconds.
Seems like... Yeah. Well, I was talking about when Atlanta, when they kicked off. It's like I kind of knew what was going to happen.
Okay.
Did you?
Right. Actually, no. I mean, I was maybe a little bit more optimistic. I thought we'd pull it out. Mm-hmm. I mean, we don't give up a... the defense doesn't allow a touchdown. Can we lose by a point? That's a crime. That's a crime. Yeah.
I had Youngway Koo-Vu because I knew what was going to happen. That kicker is solid, man. Let's talk about the consent decree first, and then I'll move on to some other things. How close is the city to getting out of the consent decree, and how much of a – are you on a headset or something, Rafael?
No, actually, I'm driving.
Okay.
Right
you on
so
Bluetooth?
I'm sorry.
That's all right. That's okay.
Yes.
We'll make it work. We don't want anything to happen bad to you. Maybe turn something down or the other. I don't know. Let's talk about the city exiting the consent decree.
Well, I think the city is on the fast path to substantial compliance. So all of that is positive. I think that the police department. Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, sir. You're doing fine.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So really what we're seeing right now is the Justice Department and the City of New Orleans are in agreement that the city is in substantial compliance. That is a major accomplishment because this whole process has been adversarial. And the city has convinced the Justice Department that they are in substantial compliance. Now we have to convince the judge that they're in substantial compliance. So what this filing from Friday indicates is that, as I just said, we're on the path. The judge will set this up for a hearing and allow the public to come in and agree or dissent with whether the city is in substantial compliance, and ultimately she will make the decision as to whether or not they're in substantial compliance. If she rules that the city is in substantial compliance, it doesn't mean that the consent decree is over. It just means we go into the next 2-year phase of wind down. And during that 2 years, the city and the police department has to maintain substantial compliance. So this has been 12 years in the making. This is an accomplishment on Friday. We still have a ways to go, but we could begin the wind down phase possibly before the end of the year. This can be scheduled for that hearing in federal court. So it's an accomplishment.
So this is a legal proceeding, and I'm just wondering, you know, I'm looking at an article here by Mike Perlstein, says the federal intervention began when the DOJ sued the city 2012 to force improvements inside of a department that had been riddled with corruption, brutality, civil rights violations, biased policing, and cronyism. I'm just wondering, from the Metropolitan Crime Commission's standpoint, how many improvements have been made? How do you compare and contrast the department now and then? And Raphael, as a follow-up question, I guess, considering this is all a negotiation, right? Where do the personalities involve, and the fact that the relationship has been, as you just said, adversarial, factor in all of this?
Well, so, you know, keep in mind, you know, really the tipping point was Katrina, post-Katrina, the Danziger Bridge incident, and several other incidents in and around Katrina. That was the tipping point where the Department of Justice had been monitoring the police department going back before Richard Pennington got here. And ultimately, that's when the Department of Justice concluded that the police department was incapable of righting itself. They entered into the consent decree. Rather than if they hadn't entered into the consent decree, the Department of Justice would have petitioned the court for a federal takeover of the police department. So where we are right now, the fact that we're on the cusp of substantial compliance, it's all based on data. Okay. The police department has been capturing data and measuring compliance in every component of that document, of that consent decree. So every paragraph has a metric attached to it, and the police department has learned how to collect that data, interpret that data, and to use that data to maintain constitutional policing practices in the city of New Orleans. The real measure of the success of this consent decree isn't right now or even 2 years when the consent decree ends, if we meet that deadline. It's going to be 5 years after the Department of Justice goes away. Because what we saw was the department has been on a roller coaster ride. It will go through periods where things are getting better, and then they will take their foot off the accelerator, and we begin to drift down the hill. So we saw what happens when we allow the department to drift down the hill. This is a never-ending process where the police department, rather than the Department of Justice, needs to make sure that their policies, practices, and procedures are a part of the culture of the police department now and in the years going forward.
So it wasn't that long ago when the city, you know, said enough is enough, and you talk about the adversarial nature of it. I'm just wondering, is the change now because of what Ann Kirkpatrick has done, either in an objective way or in a subjective way with the relationships between the DOJ and NOPD and now ultimately Judge Susie Morgan?
Well, I believe that the police department, were it not for the practices of the city and more particularly the mayor, would have been in substantial compliance sometime in late 22 or early 23. Mm-hmm. And what Ann Kirkpatrick did was convince the mayor that any thought that she had of attempting to litigate her way into substantial compliance was not going to achieve the desired goal. So once Ann Kirkpatrick got here, she was able to convince the mayor to allow the superintendent to allow her to navigate the police department into substantial compliance. We were close to it before, till the mayor decided enough is enough. I'm going to tell the city attorney and our private attorneys, we're going to litigate this thing and end the consent decree. And every effort to do that, delayed substantial compliance, has proven to be unsuccessful. And the fact that we're knocking on the door of substantial compliance is, I think, the mayor allowing Ann Kirkpatrick to do what she knows how to do, and that's lead the department, including through the consent decree process.
Is there any way to put a dollar figure on what that couple of years of delay because of the arrogance of the mayor? I'll just say it. That's what I'm thinking. You can correct me if I'm wrong. But the arrogance of the mayor could have cost the city as far as this goes?
I don't know off the top of my head. But, you know, when you factor in the money that we're paying for the federal monitors plus the legal fees involved in all this, you know, we're looking at probably approaching, you know, seven digits, $1 million+.
So, generally speaking, and I'm no Rafael Goyeneche by any means, believe me, but when you try to impose your will upon a federal judge that's appointed for life, that rarely ends happy, does it?
No, that's not a recipe for success. And everybody realized that, and Kirkpatrick realized it. To her credit, she was able to convince the mayor that she has this, let her do it, she'll get us through it. And the mayor, you know, let Ann Kirkpatrick take the reins, and that's why we are where we are right now.
And I'm just a dumb guy from the West Bank, so you think if I could figure that out, well, let me take a break, Rafael. When we come back, I want to talk to you about the Randy Farrell thing and the indictment that happened on Friday afternoon, and then we'll talk to David Hammer about that as well. Rafael Goyeneche, our guest president of the Metropolitan Crime Commission. You know, again, rule of thumb, force your will on a federal judge? Nah, probably not the best idea. We'll take a break, come back. WWL. 925, talking to Rafael Goyeneche, our friend, president of Metropolitan Crime Commission. Rafael, before we move on to Randy Farrell, somebody texted in about the, and I don't want to get too far into the weeds on this, but where Judge Susie Morgan factors into this and the Department of Justice, and what exactly happened and what are the steps next to get out of this consent decree?
Okay, so the Department of Justice and the City of New Orleans issued a joint motion last week asking the judge to move the City of New Orleans into substantial compliance. So both parties to the litigation, the city and the Department of Justice, are in agreement that the city should be placed into substantial compliance. The judge will now schedule a hearing, and the judge will review all of the metrics. The city submitted a compliance plan to maintain compliance. She will review all of that, conduct the hearing, and then make a decision whether to place the City of New Orleans and the police department into substantial compliance. When and if she does that, that begins the two-year wind-down phase. With the department, over 2 years, has to maintain compliance before the consent decree ends.
With all that being said, I know there's just speculation on your part, but how important is it, and I'm asking this question, for continuity's sake and to make sure there's no backsliding, et cetera, and everything continues to proceed smoothly, that Ann Kirkpatrick remain in place?
Well, so Ann Kirkpatrick's main accomplishment was getting the mayor to stop her flawed policy, her ineffective policy of trying to litigate her way out of it. The police department set up all of the metrics before Ann Kirkpatrick arrived to measure their compliance with the consent decree. That capability is critical to maintaining compliance, both during the consent decree, during the wind-down period, and after the consent decree goes away. What isn't measured, you know, is, you know, an indication. That's the old ways. That's what got us into the consent decree. The police department took their eye off the ball in making sure that they just didn't have policies and procedures, but those policies and procedures were actually being followed. So the blueprint to maintaining compliance, Ann Kirkpatrick, no police chief is going to be there permanently.
Right.
So it's critically important to establish the culture internally and the mechanisms internally to maintain compliance after the consent decree goes away. That mechanism is in place right now, just needs to be measured and maintained by the police department.
So let me ask it this way. On a scale of 1 to 5, 5 being difference maker, 1 being no difference at all, where would Ann Kirkpatrick fit into the change with the consent decree since she came in?
Well, we would not be in this position were it not for Ann Kirkpatrick.
Okay.
Because until Ann Kirkpatrick arrived, the mayor was still hell-bent on trying to litigate her away, huff and puff, and try and intimidate Judge Morgan into declaring the city in substantial compliance with the consent decree. That didn't work, and it wasn't going to work. And if the city was maintaining that position, we wouldn't be in the position that we now sit this morning.
So would it be accurate to say the influence was not as much on NOPD because they had already taken the right steps as to change the mayor's mindset and the proper way to go about it?
Yes, okay. I get that. That's a better way of saying it. All absolutely. Right.
Let me real quick ask you about, because we're going to talk to David Hammer about this, WWL Louisiana investigative reporter. Your thoughts on Randy Farrell being indicted that could directly implicate Mayor Cantrell in a criminal conspiracy?
Well, the only thing that I think has yet to happen is the mayor to be indicted. But this is the next step in her being indicted. And I believe that Friday's indictment of Randy Farrell, the document itself refers to Public Official 1 and Public Official 2. Public Official 1 is the mayor. Public Official 2 is the CAO of the city of New Orleans. So Randy Farrell, you know, in the indictment, is accused of bestowing gifts on Public Official 1 and Public Official 2 in an attempt to get them to use their official duties for the benefit of Randy Farrell. So go back and look at the fact that Randy Farrell was indicted for tax fraud in connection with his business, and he's paying back the government right now $1 million in back taxes. That speaks to the business, the scale of the business that he was operating. And according to the indictment, Randy Farrell influenced Public Official 1 and Public Official 2 to terminate Jennifer Cecil, who is in charge of permitting at One Stop. And by discharging her, she was giving Jennifer Cecil, was making life miserable for Randy Farrell and his company. She was on to what he was doing. And so Randy Farrell, according to this indictment, bribed or provided inducements, financial inducements and gifts to Public Official 1 and Public Official 2 to terminate Jennifer Cecil, which allowed him to continue his profitable business that we now know he's paying $1 million in restitution to the government on taxes that he didn't pay. So I think that the next step, it's a question of if, it's when the mayor is going to be indicted. I believed it before Friday. Friday, I think, indicates that it's even more imminent than it was before that indictment. But it's inevitable, and I think the mayor realizes that it's coming. It's just a matter of not if, but when.
And when it comes to these type of proceedings with the federal government, is Randy Farrell a target, or is he likely to flip, or has he flipped, or do we know?
No. I mean, he's been indicted, so he's going to be held accountable. It's a crime to accept a bribe, but it's also a crime to offer a bribe. And he's accused of not just bribing Public Official 1 and Public Official 2. He's accused of wire fraud, which was, you know, he was certifying and conducting inspections that were fraudulent. And every one of those documents that was sent via the Internet was a wire fraud. So that was his business, in allowing unlicensed contractors to receive permits that they wouldn't have been eligible. Jennifer Cecil with the city of New Orleans was aware of that and pointing that out and giving him trouble. And we now know in this indictment that the government has his cell phone records. We know from the Vappy investigation that the government had Officer Vappy's cell phone records and the mayor's cell phone records. So this case is being built in large part on the text messages, voice communications, and data from the mayor's phone, Randy Farrell's phone, Officer Vappy's phone, and probably other unnamed, unknown individuals. So it's not going to be just testimonial evidence. It's going to be digital evidence, information, and evidence of crime being perpetrated by the mayor from the mayor's own phone, from Randy Farrell's own phone, and that's going to be some of the evidence that is going to has resulted in Farrell's indictment, and I believe will be instrumental in the mayor being indicted.
Thank you, Raphael. Appreciate your time as always. Raphael Goyeneche, President of the Metropolitan Crime Commission. We're going to dig deep into this with David Hammer, WWL Louisiana Chief Investigative Reporter, when we come back. 9:34, time now for traffic, WWL. It is 9:40, 20 till 10. We're joined by David Hammer, WWL Louisiana Chief Investigative Reporter. I would imagine it was a busy time at City Hall on Friday after the indictment came down against Randy Farrell, but I'm getting ahead of myself. How you doing, David?
I'm doing well, Tommy. Yeah, Friday was quite a day, a significant day in the tenure of Mayor LaToya Cantrell and in this investigation.
Tell me why. Give me the context. You know what I like out of you, how you tell us the context and everything else and what's going on.
I try. Yeah, well, I mean, it's quite a bit, but really at the 40,000-foot level, it's the mayor of New Orleans, LaToya Cantrell, being directly implicated as an unindicted co-conspirator in a conspiracy to affect the way the city of New Orleans does business. And importantly, it's in safety, in the business of making sure that buildings are safe and electricians are doing safe work. And there's an inspector named Randy Farrell. He was indicted on Friday and charged with a conspiracy to commit fraud in which he paid things of value to the mayor and also allegedly to the deputy CAO, to the CAO, the chief administrative officer of the city of New Orleans, Gilbert Montaño, and gave them gifts and asked them to get rid of a employee in the safety and permits department who was investigating him and finding that he was allegedly paying for permits for unlicensed contractors, unlicensed electricians, which of course is significant because electrical work can be quite dangerous if not done correctly, and was allowing this work to go forward and then inspecting it on the back end and saying it was safe. And
his own jobs, right?
Essentially, yeah. I mean, he was inspecting the jobs of unlicensed people who were paying him bribes to allow the work to go forward. Okay. And then he was inspecting it and saying it was safe and good to go. And it laid out dozens of these specific cases, cases where homeowners came in and found out that the work was done improperly and was not up to code after the fact, even though he and other inspectors who worked for him were saying that it was safe and the city of New Orleans was accepting it as safe. And when the city tried to step in and do something about it through the director of the one-stop shop, which is basically the permitting process of the city of New Orleans. The director at the time was Jennifer Cecil. This is back in 2019. And she had sent checks that Randy Farrell signed to pay for these fake permits and sent them to the inspector general of the city of New Orleans and said, hey, look at this. This is what I found. And when he got wind of it, he started pressing for the Mayor LaToya Cantrell to get rid of Jennifer Cecil. And there were a series of gifts that he allegedly gave to the mayor, starting with the NFC Championship game, $6,000 worth of tickets to the NFC Championship game, which people may recall as the NOLA no-call game where the Saints were robbed of the trip to the Super Bowl at the very end of the game. and then continuing on with additional football tickets, the Saints tickets for the allegedly for the national championship game the following year that featured LSU at the Superdome for the CAO, Gilbert Montagno. He did confirm to me that he ended up in a suite at that game in an interview that he gave me on Friday, but he says that he was not taking tickets to do any favors for anybody and would never do that. But that is the allegation in this indictment, and it's a 25-count felony count indictment. It's pretty serious. Now, I should say the gifts to the mayor that are outlined in this indictment only add up to about $10,000. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason you don't see the mayor being indicted yet is that they have been building over the last 2 years, as we've reported extensively, they've been building various avenues where the mayor may have been enriched in exchange, you know, allegedly in exchange for you know, benefits. And it's interesting because I first started reporting on this almost a year ago. We got the documents showing that Jennifer Cecil was fired or terminated because of her work trying to expose this stuff. And my colleague Katie Moore was able to get an interview with the mayor last December, mm-hmm. and asked her specifically about whether she was doing things to make things easier for Randy Farrell. And she denied it on camera. And that's exactly what she is now being accused of as an unindicted co-conspirator with Randy Farrell in this indictment. So, again, she has not been charged with a crime, but she is directly implicated in a criminal indictment with felony conspiracy charges. And so, you know, the federal government, federal agents and federal U.S. attorney, they do not name sitting public officials like this if they do not plan to also indict them. I think you had Rafael Goyeneche on mm-hmm. from the Metropolitan Crime Commission just before me, and he was saying that it's not if but when the mayor will be indicted. We will see, but it would be extremely damaging and embarrassing for the U.S. Attorney's Office to implicate the mayor so directly as they have in this indictment and then not follow through.
Yeah, I'm looking at your story here. The indictment alleges Farrell bought Cantrell coveted tickets to the New Orleans Saints' second-ever home NFC Championship game, the no-call, fancy lunch at Ruth's Chris Steakhouse in August 2019, a new iPhone in December 2019, gifts a total of more than $9,200. That doesn't seem like a lot to You understand what I'm saying?
That's exactly right, Tommy. Yeah, no, I mean, that's exactly what I was trying to get at a little bit a few minutes ago. The amount here is not something that would to draw a comparison. Back when Mayor Ray Nagin was indicted, the only mayor to be convicted of bribery and fraud while in office from his time in office in the city of New Orleans, he was indicted and convicted based on taking hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of benefits in exchange for official acts to help people, to help contractors get contracts and to smooth the way for them to get more business. And so that compared to $10,000 is what gives you pause here, that they have to have a lot more to be willing to go forward. And they are essentially showing their cards at the feds are showing their cards here by charging Randy Farrell with, you know, the case against Randy Farrell is pretty clear and solid based on the documentation that they have with all these text messages and everything. But you don't make that move and name public official one, who is the mayor of New Orleans, if you don't have more coming behind it to charge the mayor with directly. And like you say, they would not move just based on this. We've reported that there's other tentacles to this investigation, including benefits through a image consultant that the mayor had, and we've reported about that investigation. And if you compare it to the Nagin case had all these separate tentacles as well. Mm-hmm. He was getting, you may recall, the trip to Hawaii mm-hmm. that was paid for by a vendor. He was getting the Stone Age his son's granite countertop business was getting business through the Home Depot. There were, you know, other tentacles with the Market Street power plant and payments made directly to Nagin as soon as he left office, totaling over $100,000. So there were all these different alleged schemes that were proven in the Nagin case. And here, so far, you only have one alleged scheme so far involving the mayor, LaToya Cantrell, allegedly enriching herself. So they would have to have a lot more to go forward with charges against her. But by bringing these direct charges that implicate her, it suggests that they must have something that they still haven't come with to charge her with, because, like you say, $10,000 is not a lot.
So where does Fouad Zitton fit in all of this?
Well, he's the go-between. You know, he used to own the Magnolia Mansion, and he's very gregarious, and he knows a lot of the politicians and judges around town, and he's close with the mayor. When the mayor won election, he got up there with his champ. He was a former boxer, and he got up mm-hmm. there with his championship belt to put around her. And he was business partners with Randy Farrell. So when the mayor would communicate about things with Randy Farrell, and when Randy Farrell would communicate about things with the mayor, it was done through Fouad Zitton. And Fouad Zitton was convicted in a case involving art insurance fraud.
Right, yeah.
And when he was caught with that, they got his cell phone, and his cell phone it has some pretty damning messages on them where they're discussing specifically Randy Farrell's attempts to get the mayor to fire Jennifer Cecil. And when Jennifer Cecil was informed in August 2019 that she was being fired, he celebrates by saying the bee is gone, and they're, you know, excited. And then he gets this cell phone allegedly for the mayor, and they take a picture at the mall, at Lakeside Mall, on Christmas Eve 2019. And Randy Farrell texts, "Tell her Merry Christmas," to Fouad Zitton. So they have some very, very specific text messages that show that there was a quid pro quo there, at least from Randy Farrell's perspective. Now, the question is, will the mayor claim that this was not done as any kind of favor? But, you know, the evidence is clearly there and laid out in this very detailed indictment, you know, showing that they have text messages where he is specifically saying, when are they going to get rid of her? She's got to get rid of her. You got to talk to her. You know, we got her this great thing. We got her, the tickets. We got her and then days after they have this fancy lunch, about, I think it was like $800 lunch at Ruth's Chris, mm-hmm. then Jennifer Cecil was informed that she's being fired.
It was the sides that ran up the bill. I'm just making a Wolf of Wall Street joke. When it comes to Randy Farrell, is he in a position now to cooperate, or is it too late for him now that he's been indicted, or is there potentially, and you don't know, I know, but I'm just wondering the way the process works. Go ahead.
I think you make a great point there, Tommy, because he absolutely does have an opportunity to cooperate. You know, he was convicted of tax fraud in December 2021, and they had a lot of this information, if not all of it, at the federal level, and did not charge him with this fraud scheme that they're alleging now. That he was he's on probation and paying back money over $1 million that he allegedly essentially stole from the IRS by committing tax fraud. And so if he the allegations in this indictment are that he continued with this conspiracy until September 2023, which, and I've reported about this, he sent an email in September 2023 to the Director of Safety and Permits and said, "I told Mayor LaToya Cantrell she needed to get rid of Jennifer Cecil." And so the allegations in this indictment is that he continued doing this through September 2023, which was when he was still on probation and being punished for the tax fraud. So if he violated, if this establishes that he was committing crimes while he was still on probation for the tax fraud, then that could, you know, cause him to go be essentially in trouble again for the tax fraud. That would, you know, kick things back on his punishment there so that he would not be done with his punishment. And that it would be an inducement for him to
David,
cooperate
real quick,
with the
real
government.
Quick before I let you go, legally, does it matter if it was $10,000 or if it was $100,000?
It doesn't, but, you know, you don't see it for $10,000 mm-hmm. against a sitting mayor of a major city like New Orleans. That's the difference.
They might have worked that out instead of the indictment process or something along those lines.
Potentially, but I think it means that there's a lot more
coming.
That's
what I mean. And real quick, if Fouad Zeitoun doesn't engage in art fraud, do the feds have any of this?
I don't think so. I don't think so.
All right. Thank you, David. Appreciate it as always. David Hammer, WWL Louisiana Chief Investigative Reporter. Newell is live today for Pelicans Media Day, along with Deuce. We'll check in with him when we come back. WWL.